This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Government hands, corporate money.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Good morning from American Public Media in Los Angeles. I'm Steve Chiatakis. The White House and Treasury want to keep more tax money, but business isn't going to like it. A handful of big banks say they're less stressed than Uncle Sam has painted them, but if that's the case, why are some of them raising capital? It's the morning open, less than a half an hour into the trading day. We ask the question, where's Wall Street? Dow is up more than a percent, 1.1% at this hour, 93 points. NASDAQ up about a percent, as is the S&P 500. Asian markets up big time today, although the Nikkei was on holiday. The Hang Seng rocketed up 5.5%, and European markets are mostly up as well. In just a couple of hours, President Obama and Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner will put forward a proposal that would keep a lot of money in tax coffers. It's a plan that would save the government more than $210 billion over the next decade. Here's Marketplace's Steve Henn.
U.S. companies are able to shelter a lot of the income they earn abroad from the IRS. So today, President Obama will call for tightening the tax code and closing loopholes that cost the government tens of billions of dollars a year.
Well, the government desperately needs revenue. So, revenue enhancers are going to look awfully attractive to Congress right now.
Jim Hines is a professor of law and economics at Michigan University.
You know, as it currently stands, the United States has the toughest regime of taxing foreign income of any country in the world. It hardly seems like a good idea to enact anti-competitive tax policies, and that's the problem.
The president's plan's likely to face some opposition in Congress. Businesses have been lobbying for years for the feds to lower the top corporate tax rate. They argue the 35% rate is one of the highest in the world and puts them at a competitive disadvantage. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
All right, let's chat this morning with Sam Stovall, Chief Investment Strategist at S&P Equity Research, joining us from New York on the line. Sam, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Thanks for being with us. Seems like we have this two-headed spin machine going on here. On one hand, oh, everything's fine. On the other, let's raise some more capital. We talked about some of these banks that are needing more money. What's going on with the banks, Sam?
Well, Steve, it seems as if the report that's going to be coming out the next couple of days might end up being almost anticlimactic. These banks have been analyzed and speculated upon seven ways to Sunday. We've seen reports in the financial media indicating that several of them will probably need to raise capital in order to make sure that they can weather the worst case scenario, which would be looking toward another 7% decline in housing prices, as well as an unemployment rate that reaches and exceeds 10%.
We got word this morning, Sam, that Bank of America said it does not have plans to raise the $10 billion in common equity, as the Financial Times had reported. So there's that out there. But also we have stocks now down just a bit. The Dow is up about a full percent at this hour. You know, this tax proposal put forth by the Obama administration, money in the short term, right? But does it generate another fallout later on?
Well, I think certainly it's a little bit of a concern. The government has stepped up. It has spent a lot of money in order to support the banks, in order to try to stimulate the economy and consumers, and they have to pay for it. So one way of doing that is looking for profits overseas that right until now, it's only when they get translated back to U.S. dollars that they can get taxed. But the Obama administration is saying maybe we can tap this reserve at this point to help pay for what we've already spent. I think that could be a concern on Wall Street, since we estimate that 48% of the revenues of companies in the S&P come from overseas operations.
All right. Sam Stovall, Chief Investment Strategist at S&P Equity Research, joining us from New York. Sam, thanks.
Good to talk to you, Steve.
You're hearing The Morning Report on Monday, May 4th, 2009 at marketplace.org. You know, last week we got word that Chrysler and Italy's Fiat would be joining hands in the quest to make small, fuel-efficient cars here in the United States. Now Fiat CEO is talking with the German government about taking over General Motors' Opel unit there, all part of a plan to turn itself into one of the world's top three automakers. More from our man in London, Stephen Beard.
The plan is extraordinarily bold. Fresh from agreeing to take over a large chunk of Chrysler, Fiat now wants GM's European divisions as well. That's Opel in Germany, Vauxhall in Britain, and also perhaps the Swedish company Saab. The combined group would have car sales of between 6 and 7 million a year. That would put Fiat on a par with Volkswagen, just behind Toyota. Fiat's first hurdle comes this afternoon. The company will seek clearance from the German government to take over GM's Opel. Chris Brady of the BPP Business School thinks the German government will agree.
They're not going to allow any state aid to go in, and rather than let the company go under, my view is that they'll allow this to happen.
There's a certain irony here. 5 years ago, GM paid Fiat $2 billion as a penalty for not buying the Italian car business. Fiat used that money to turn itself around. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
So what kind of children will result from this Fiat-Chrysler marriage? What kind of cars and trucks will this new company offer American buyers? The standard line is better and more fuel efficient, but will American buyers bite? Here's Marketplace's John Dimsdale.
The Fiat Topolino, one of Europe's first economy cars.
Before Fiat abandoned the U.S. in the early 1980s, it went after the early market for saving money at the gas pump.
The Fiat Strada. Strada combines the best gas mileage of any compact car in America.
Fuel efficiency is fashionable again, so expect smaller Chryslers that look like, among other models, the Mini Cooper-sized Fiat 500. Chrysler is known for stodgier suburban minivans and could also use another type of fashion.
That whole Italian thing is unique.
Roger Hart, the managing editor for Auto Week in Detroit, says Chrysler needs a more sporty image.
Part of this mix, we would hope, would also be the lineup from Alfa Romeo, which had also talked about coming into the U.S. market even before this hookup with Fiat and Chrysler.
Analysts say Fiat's sportier cars will aim at a more urban customer, and that would mean moving Chrysler dealerships from the suburbs to the city. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Despite the fallout, one firm has been on a hiring spree. Apple Computers has been signing up microchip designers at a brisk pace. Although the company hasn't quite said so, Apple is apparently moving into the chip business, as Joel Rose reports.
The first clue came last year when Apple bought up a boutique chip design firm. Since then, Apple has enlisted lots more people with microchip experience. It all suggests that the company intends to design the next generation of iPhone and iPod chips in-house.
They really are annoyed by anybody who wants to clone them. So if someone who wants to clone the iPhone, they could do so simply by using some of the same chips. If Apple owns those chips, it can stop that from happening.
Dean Takahashi writes for the Silicon Valley blog VentureBeat. He says the move has risks, too.
There's a lot of engineering costs that they're going to incur here, but they're also not going to be paying out a lot of money to those chip makers who are doing the designs right now.
If the strategy works, Takahashi says Apple could essentially declare independence from Intel, Samsung, and other chip makers. That's a big if, but with $29 billion in the bank, Apple seems well-positioned to try. I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
Credit will soon be flowing a little easier to businesses thanks to a change in the Small Business Administration's main lending program. Companies that used to be a bit too big for SBA loans will now qualify. The primary beneficiary will be car dealerships. From the Entrepreneurship Desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, here's Mitchell Hartman.
70,000 more businesses are now eligible for government-guaranteed bank loans. That's because the upper limits on net worth and annual income have been raised temporarily, which will allow one particular group to qualify. Eric Zarnikow is with the SBA.
Clearly, there's an impact or a benefit to the auto dealers, RV dealers, auto suppliers.
Most car dealers make way more income than the typical small business, so under the old rules, they didn't qualify for SBA loans. And right now, many need those loans, says Mike Martin. He owns two GM dealerships in Manassas, Virginia.
I think the real fear that a lot of dealers have is availability of credit. That is probably what keeps most of us up at night.
Dealers have been squeezed hard by the credit crunch. They need to borrow to buy the vehicles on their car lots. And Martin says, although thousands of dealerships may close as GM and Chrysler restructure, the ones that survive will have to upgrade and retool. And they'll need ready access to credit for that as well. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
For decades, population declines in many states in the Great Plains have put a squeeze on local business and tax revenue. But now one small town in Nebraska is trying to turn things around. Alex Schmidt reports.
The town of Ord is smack in the middle of Nebraska. It has a population of just 2,200. But here at a local convenience store, there are about 20 racks filled with magazines and brochures promoting tourism around the region. There are pictures of teenagers jet skiing on a scenic river. You can read an article about the historic fort in Ord and learn about their quaint town square. Caleb Pollard, director at the Ord Chamber of Commerce, says these days a $60 all-inclusive wine tasting near Ord is more attractive to big city folks than that two-week holiday in Europe.
It's quirky and it's different, too. I mean, how many people can say that they went out and went wine tasting in the sandhills of central Nebraska?
But tourism can only bring in so many dollars. One of the real challenges to a community like this is population decline and brain drain. Ord has created incentives for new businesses, like leasing land for just a dollar an acre. And the town has a network to let people know, using email newsletters, a blog, even a Facebook page.
Yeah, out of sight, out of mind, inside in mind type of thing.
25-year-old Luke Kavorek left Ord for college, and those newsletters convinced him to move back. Many of his friends are considering doing the same, but there's one thing holding them back. Not enough women.
I know, like, the one kid, and he wants to move to Ord in the worst way, but he's going to stay in Omaha until he finds a girl and then try and move back.
It could take a while before people like Kavorek move to Ord en masse. Will Lamb has studied small-town innovation at the University of North Carolina. He says the time it takes can vary widely.
To me, it depends on what the asset that the community is trying to leverage for economic development is and how easy is it to turn that asset into some real value.
Lamb says it took several decades for Branson, Missouri to turn itself into a country music mecca, but it took just a couple of years for the town of Scotland Neck in North Carolina to reimagine itself as an outdoor recreation destination. In Ord, Nebraska, I'm Alex Schmidt for Marketplace.
Set to get more economic barometers this week, construction spending today, April unemployment on Friday, and things have been pretty sour at best. But there's one gauge of the economy that's been on an upswing, the stock market, and that lends itself to the question of whether that's a sign of things to come.
And now it's time for the Sloan Sessions.
Fortune Magazine's Alan Sloan is with us right now. Alan, do stocks really make a difference in the outlook of things?
Well, we can make that at least some of us have a lot more wealth than we did 2 months ago, you know, which is always nice, and that you can see there's a spirit of optimism created by the fact that stocks are up because that's the indicator most people see, and they tend to be happier when it's up than when it's down.
These stocks, namely the S&P 500, it's one of the leading economic indicators that the Conference Board looks at, right?
Right. And there's a myth in the world that when the stock market goes up, it means the economy is going to be strong, you know, a few months down the road, and that when the market goes down, it's forecasting economic weakness. And that's the reason that the Conference Board uses this as one of the indicators. However, there are at least 10 others, some of which have greater weight in the calculations than the stock market does. There's the difference between long-term and short-term rates. There are all sorts of things about construction and orders and applications for unemployment insurance. So the S&P 500, which is what they use, is one of 11 indicators and not the most important one. And that's because it is not terribly reliable.
So what indicator would you look at? What's the most accurate one, the one that you've looked at that you say, this is how I'm going to determine what the heck's going on?
I don't pretend to know what the economy is going to do in the short run. so I don't clutter what few neurons I have remaining in my mind by worrying about things like this, because I know I can't predict it. I try not to get involved in things where I know I'm going to mess up.
Fortune Magazine's Alan Sloan joining us from New York. Alan, thank you.
You're welcome.
Let's check Wall Street one more time. The Dow is up about 1.2% at this hour, 95 points. NASDAQ, S&P up about an average of 1%. And more at our website, The Scratch Pad, with our online host and blogger, Scott Jagow, inside marketplace.org in Los Angeles. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for being with us. Have a great Monday.
American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.